Welcome to another episode of The Brand Called You. Today, I am indeed privileged and honored to have a good friend and a highly decorated soldier from Sri Lanka. Air Chief Marshal Harsha Abe Vikrama, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Harsha was the 13th Chief of Air Staff of Sri Lanka and he is a highly decorated soldier. So Harsha, tell me a little bit about your early work and some of your early learnings when you joined the Sri Lankan Air Force.
Right. Actually, I was, from my childhood, I was passionate to become a pilot. And so that's how I ended up in the Air Force, because Air Force was the cheaper option. When we joined in L80, the Sri Lankan, in Sri Lanka is a small country, had only one flying club. Mm-hmm. And then the Air Force was like 2,500 people, where it's very peaceful country before this war started.
Right.
And then I attended a school called Royal College in Colombo 7. Uh-huh. And from there, I joined the Air Force.
Right.
And from there, I joined as an officer cadet.
Correct.
And then when the war started, mm-hmm. and then we graduated. When we went to training and here, went to Western countries. I've been to UK, USA, India, Pakistan, Israel, yeah. China. In most of these countries, I attend training because we didn't have all our training was there. Then the war started, and then there was a demand for pilots to become attack pilots. So I was one of the first who was selected to become a attack pilot, and then I was the first one who went abroad, and I got the first supersonic flight squadron, and I became the commanding officer of that squadron. I've been base commanders on most of the bases of Sri Lanka. So as a pilot, when you joined as officer cadet, you become officer. Then when you become a pilot, you know, in the Air Force, the people then, or the pilots will get squadron commander jobs. Then from there, they become base commanders. Then they'll become directors of air operations. Yeah. Then the chief of staff, and then you end up the career. That was kind of a brief outlook.
That's amazing. And to end up as chief of air staff is a very, very big position for someone who starts off right at the bottom, you know.
Yes, that's right.
General Field, you know, Field Marshal Manekshaw used to say, every soldier carries
a trophy.
So,
yes, that's right.
Congratulations. That's amazing.
Thank you.
You know, I've spoken to a few army officers also on my show. And my question to you is the same. What does the Air Force train you for? And what does it teach you?
Yes. Actually, we call it, in the Air Force, we were taught, you come from a civil street, you make a disorganized rebel into an orderly human being.
Correct.
You know, that was kind of a thing, because you come from various, you are a disorganized person. Mm. Then you are given the military training, like drill, to obey the orders, to act as a team. Mm. You know, you say, turn right, everybody will turn right. That is what is the drill is. So you initially, you break a person, everybody does the same thing. You break him from civilian to a military, that is, you're a disorganized rebel, they call it. Mm. Then you make a new organized human being, organized person who is receptive to orders, who will know to carry on, so few people will drop away. So then you get that material, then he can be started, could be trained further into whatever. So Air Force generally is structured around the flying. Hmm. So generally, the pilots are there. So the other branches, engineering, the other branches are to support the flying machines, the flying operation.
Correct.
So that is there'll be branches, there'll be the pilots are called general duties pilot branch. That is because they have to do all the other duties, because they are the ones who will command one day. Hmm. So only a pilot could become an air chief.
Correct.
Because it's basically based on flying.
Absolutely.
And the others will step up into a second, third level, but they will have their own functions. Engineering will have it. There'll be engineering will be broken into aircraft engineering and the ground engineering. Then there'll be a security setup, then the administration, then the logistics on the supply chain. Mm-hmm. So the people are trained basically to gear into those trades. Compared to other militaries, the Air Force is different, but more technically because there is so much of machinery, technology involved. So the people are taken at a little higher IQ standards. Even as a soldier, if you take an airman, they have to be able to read a manual and understand the manual and employ, because most of the equipment will be originally manufactured in another country. There the manual will come, the training will come, so they'll have to do the servicing. They'll have to read the manuals. And, you know, those are the types of trainings we have in the Air Force.
Very nice. You know, so my father was a retired brigadier general, and, you know, highly decorated soldier. And I often used to ask him, and I'm going to ask you the same question.
Sure.
What is it in the training of a soldier that motivates him to make the ultimate sacrifice for his country?
Yes.
I mean, because the government doesn't do it.
Yes, because of the training. The training, generally, you know, they are grilled into acting on the order. And they will make, you will be taught things, you know, your ambience from the day one would be that this is your job, to look after your country. The job is to look after your teammates, to look after your assets. So you can, because life is the secondary then.
Correct.
Then you are given the task, immaterial of the outcome. They say not to ask why, but to do and die.
Right.
You know, that is a saying which has come from the military. You know, it's very strange. It's because military soldier is the person, we have got a lot of experience with this war. Right. You know, people, if you look at the executive world, people get about one third of the salary soldier used to get. But they sacrifice, they are okay with it, they are very happy, because it is a grilling, it is a training. Now if you see this Marine SEALs and all training, no, you are driven to a limit and push, this is, you know, and you, because the training is such that you can be motivated to sacrifice your life even, because other things come secondary. Whatever the task is the one, then the life, the family, everything. So actually, it is sometimes you can see it's unfair, but the system is such that it is the training, the leaders in the hierarchy of the military is drilled to say that, okay, if there's a team who say, don't ask questions, this is your plan, it is execution. Then everybody understands in the front line that, you know, one or two people will not come back. Even as a fighter pilot, as you take off, you won't come back. I lived about 10-15 years. Every day in the morning, I think this is the last time. When you go home, you don't think that you will come back again. You know, something like that.
Very interesting. So one more question about you in the Air Force, and then I'll move on.
Sure.
You know, when I was reading about you on the Air Force website, it says that you were the first pilot to get trained for fighter jets during the separatist conflict of the 80s.
Right.
Tell me more about this experience.
Correct.
You know,
what happened? What happened was, I'll tell you the story. This conflict started around 1984. You know, it was time to escalate. It was, so when we joined in 80, it was kind of a ceremonial air force. And there had been some fighters, which are basic fighters. There had been a conflict, small conflict, which has happened in 1971. So the Russians, with Mrs. Sirimo Bandaranaike time, Russians quickly donated like a very basic mid, I think 15 type of aircraft, three aircraft. And there were some Royal Air Force remnants called Jet Provost. And they were all grounded by the 1980, because that was suddenly brought in for that conflict. That conflict didn't last even 1 week. So that had ended. So therefore, Air Force didn't have any single aircraft fitted with weapons.
Okay.
Serviceable aircraft. So we grew up on the ceremonial type of airports, like Avros. They have a transport and they have a few helicopters.
Right.
Helicopters were for VIP, mostly for VIP and our passengers going here and there. You know, that's why I said when we joined, there was this Air Force grew to about 50,000. But when I joined, it was like 1,500, 2,000 type of Air Force. Very, very small unit, because Sri Lanka was a small country. So then when the war started, we were the most youngest pilots who were exposed. Actually, I can recall that some army says there is a conflict. There was a time that small training aircraft, they put a grenade onto a glass, remove the pin and throw it from above. just to, you know, that is a very rudimentary, very basic type of equipment we had. So then they started developing, that they brought in some weapons to fit into helicopters, some few new helicopters were bought. It was happening very rapidly, our force was growing. Then we initially stuck in the first ground attack aircraft was a basic Siamacetti Italian aircraft, built in like Augusta, that company from Italy. And they were the ones which could be fitted. They were also basic ground attack aircraft, actually a very good training aircraft. It's Italian. And it could fast move, and then you can fix two rocket posts. So I was one of the first pilots to train in that. And so we went and we were giving ground support to the air force, the ground troops. And then there was a time when our enemy was developing much faster in with terms of equipment and all that. So they thought it was like a very small terrorist organization, but their international support was too much. And they grew, like sometimes, I remember when you were young, the first rocket propelled grenade called RPG was brought in by the LTT before our Sri Lankan army in 1980. So that's that type of thing. So then our people were compelled, then they got in this, there was an aircraft called Pucara they got from Argentina, and then they got a thing called a Siamacetti. So like those are the basic ground attack aircraft we had, but that was also not sufficient because there was information they were getting missiles.
Right.
So that is the time when our Air Force decided, that the government, that they need to go outside. But at the same time, there was an embargo in the international, because they were thinking that we were having a conflict with our own people. You know, the politics of the international politics. So therefore, none of the Western countries offered us anything to be sold. So then only China offered this type of aircraft. Then this was the F-7, which was offered to us. It is equivalent of MiG-21 that you all are having. And this aircraft was offered to Sri Lanka. Then, and they also said that they needed pilots who had some jet hours, at least 200 jet flying hours, to get into that conversation, the conversion. Then what happened was, we didn't have a single pilot who had any. So then the Air Force went into a brainstorming, probably, I don't know how, what happened. They decided, there were senior people, than me also, but they decided me that, okay, they called me and said, we have a thing like this, you have to go to China and sell us whether we can absorb this. Because they are asking for background pilot, but we don't have any. You go and take the decision and see. So I was very privileged. I don't know, maybe I was such a daredevil type of a young man. They decided this guy can do it or whatever. That was those days, maybe through foolishness or whatever. We were like really going into it, and you know, you don't care whatever. So, and I was actually, I have become the best pilot and best cadet pilot here in time. No, I was okay with that. Some reason, my flying was very good. I used to like aerobatics and all that. And then I was sent to China. Went to China. Then it was the biggest challenge was that there was Chinese pilot. And I don't know Chinese. Chinese pilot doesn't know English. And the interpreter has not flown any aircraft. And only two people can go in the plane. So I sit in the front. The Chinese pilot sitting in the behind, then the interpreter is in the tower. Even if he has to tell something to me, right. It was one of the biggest challenges, because we used to do briefing. And so I did few sorties in the initially. Then they asked me, Sri Lankan authority. Then they flew there, that time they are chief and the chief of engineering. They asked me, I said, yes, we can do it. But you must allow me to decide who is the pilots I am going to take. Because by that time, I had become a flying instructor. So I knew kind of the market who was in the Air Force, because everybody, it has then by that time, we have grown into about 100 pilots and all that. So then I said, if you gave me interest, I will want my decision making, I will select the pilot. They said, okay. So that is how it started the conversion. Then that was a big challenge. Then we came back to Sri Lanka. There also, Chinese also came here and they started training. This is how it happened.
Amazing. What an amazing journey.
Yeah.
So let's move to another part of our show, Harsha. You were just telling me before we started recording that, you know, you are a Buddhist, of course, but now you've got doing a lot of reading on Buddhist philosophy.
Correct. Yes.
Tell me a little bit about this interest other than the religion? And what what are you wanting to do with this?
Well, actually, what the Buddha has taught is not a religion, actually. It's a way of life. He has not invented anything new. Yeah. But my understanding is that if you look at the Vedic literature, you know, the Buddha was born in your country as a Hindu. Okay, apparently there were 62 types of faiths when he was born. You know, about 58 were saying that there is something, 4 people are saying there is nothing. You know, either you have or you have, you call it Shunyata and all that.
Correct.
So that is the time the Siddhartha is born. Then he had this best of his lives and all that, you know. Then he realized that there is no ultimate happiness, satisfaction, whether you become a king, you have the best of everything, because he says that whatever happens, you will get old, you will get sick, and you will die.
Correct.
So there is no thing, this cycle will continue as samsara and all that. So he went into the Vedic available the teachings that time, and then he went up to the Nevasanya, Nasanya, the Dhyanas, and you know, all these levels. But there also he realized that you can go into a Dhyana for 150 years, but still you have to come back, and then this life will, this row, this cycle will continue. Then he thought, I must seek something which will never, I cannot come back. This cause and effect phenomena will not happen. The cycle has to be ended. So this is what he went in seeking. That is what actually what I think is Buddha taught a very deep science. The everything else was there. Even still what your Vedic literature says, everything is there. So what has happened now is the Buddhist people taken most of the Vedic things also as their basic thing, and they are telling the last part where Buddha said about this Vidarshana part, and they are trying to connect it and project it. So anybody sees that this has been there for 6,000 years in India. And so that is the other reason that most Indians didn't become Buddhists, because it is too advanced, the last part of it. Because he, Buddha, my understanding, I mean, you don't have to believe me or anybody, I am not saying with authority, but this is my finding, is that Buddha, apparently, he thought about this signal as a, you know, he said that there is no person, thing or whatever. It is a, whatever arises in your mind and which passes away at the same time, you know. And it is a very fast moving thought, arising, passing away, arising away. It's a series of thoughts. You call it life.
Yes.
You take as your mind and think that, okay, you are Dhok, I Ashutosh, I am the king of guardian, I am this. But if you are in a deep sleep, you don't know whether you are an elephant or an ant, no?
Absolutely.
So that is what I have learned. So, and there is a path, there is a way, if you look at the world, start looking at it, then your mind becomes developed and developed and developed. Your vision becomes very focused and improved and all that. Then you start seeing, because it is like without a mirror, if you want to see your eye from your eye, it is different. So this is like, there is this mind.
Yeah.
From the mind, you have to look at this consciousness type of thing. It is, but it is like a mirror.
Yeah.
All are elusive, whatever we see.
Correct.
It is like they say, if you call what is in front of you a book now, but if your mother taught it to say the table is a book and book is the table, we'll be calling it. There is nothing wrong in that. So see, the world is totally full of words. Actually, our world is only words.
Correct.
If you really look at it. Because the objects what we see are also arising within our mind. So therefore, my thinking is that we, if human beings try, but you need a little bit of higher level of a, you know, it is not the PhD knowledge. It is a different type of a wisdom kind of a thing which they have taught.
Correct.
That is very different to the people say that, because whoever takes a PhD or become masters, double this, that, they have taken somebody else's knowledge and they have by heart then pass exams and then they, you know, available information. But this is beyond the world. This is a different thing. So that is what I have understood right now.
That's so well articulated, you know, during this lockdown period.
Correct.
I actually did an 8-day course on Buddhism from Harvard University. online.
Oh,
you know, and what you're saying makes so much sense, and something that I was reading about. So you're absolutely right.
Yeah. So, and also what the benefit to us is that now actually for the, you asked me, I think there was, is there anybody, whatever that, I have a story for that actually.
I'm coming to that now to ask.
Okay,
you.
Let's talk. Yeah.
You know, are there any people who had an influence on you?
Yeah. So this is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
During the period of my thing, I was posted to a base, you know, in Anuradhapura. The Anuradhapura is our ancient capital, you know, where the Irrawan Valley. The Buddha, it is very close to where the Hindu, the Emperor Ashoka's son arrived, and you know, he apparently they are supposed to have brought the talents and all that from that Indian time, India, with their all the experts of various trades.
Hmm.
So that there is a Air Force base there. I was appointed as the base commander in 1998 that time.
Right.
So before that, I was in the US Air Force. I had a scholarship for about 1 year plus. So during the Air Force training, I met a chaplain. The guys called chaplains.
Yeah.
They are officers.
Mm-hmm.
They also move with you in the Air Force. They have a rank. They call major and all that.
Yeah.
And they are chubbies to counsel people if they are going outstation. I mean, if you are in another country, somebody dies, they'll do the prayers and all that. So this person got in touch with me, and then I used to ask him what is Allah and what is Jesus, and you know, we used to have a chats and all that. And I was quite intrigued, and suddenly he told me about Buddhism.
Hmm.
So I was thinking that, you know, I am a Buddhist born.
Hmm.
He is teaching me things, and I felt that Buddha has said something very good. Suddenly it clicked. So I realized that day, I was in US Maxwell Air Force Base.
Hmm.
I said, the day I go to Sri Lanka, I want to start this. I want to learn. I want to look somebody.
Hmm.
But then when I came to Sri Lanka, but I couldn't do anything because I was posted to as commanding officer in Jaffna, you know, the Palali.
Hmm.
There is an air base. I was sent there directly. He said, you know, that is how in Sri Lanka, you know, okay, you are in USA, come here, you will get the work. So it is like you are coming from here and going to Kargil, you know. In your case.
In India, it's called a punishment posting after you got a very good posting.
So that is what I was. So, alright, so I was there. Uh-huh. Then from there only I got the, and it was the Flying Training Academy was in Trincomalee.
Mm-hmm.
So it was set to in Anuradhapura. So I was the commandant of the academy plus the base commander, you know. So it was like a very academic kind of a background. So we have enough time to read, you know. So then I asked my sister was into it. Anyway, they were really strong Buddhists, used to practice. I asked my sister, tell me somebody who I can learn.
Hmm.
Then she said, well, there is this priest, I went to Anuradhapura, that day I went to a sermon, he's very deep, he talks about deep science. I don't know whether you'll understand it, she said.
Hmm.
I thought, oh, that's another challenge. You know, when you're young, you're very confident, cocky, and you think, what the hell, you know, there's something we cannot understand.
Yeah.
So I said, right then I went in search of him, I found him. And I went and said, the Reverend, I don't know anything. He said, that's the best.
Mm.
Come and sit. And that is from that day I have been with him. And totally from that time, actually, when he talked about the real type of philosophy that I'm talking, not these the basics, but the advanced, where you look at the life as a signal, and that signal is an illusion type of a realization.
Correct.
And then from there, my life has become so successful, actually, if I may tell you. You know, because I applied it quickly to my thing, and then I thought, okay, there is nothing permanent. Just like I take happiness and health as priority, money and all will come anyway. And my top priority from life from that day has become, I will concentrate on happiness and health. Because anyway, this life will end. Until you end it, you will be healthy and happy. That is the one. Otherwise, you will just not do anything.
Very well said. So, Harsha, I've got time for one more question.
Okay.
And I have so many to ask you, but unfortunately, the clock won't let me. So, my question is that if you were a role model to millions of children who closely followed you, as I'm sure people do in Sri Lanka, because you know you were the former Air Chief, and these people looked at your life choices, what would be the one thing you would change in yourself?
Well, actually, I won't change anything, but had I knew this knowledge about 30 years ago, I won't allow myself to have a belly, or I would have been more concentrating on physical, you know, to maintaining my ability, because I have now realized it is not the age, it is how you train your energies and your food in your body, then where you can, you can change yourself.
Right.
So whatever I have abused during the past is in vain, I think. If I had this knowledge that I have now, I could have, you know, I would be like very, very comfortable. I would be running 10 miles. Or, I mean, not that I want to go to extremes, but your health, you would have done few things which you have done, I would not do that. So other than that, all my decisions, I'm very happy and content with, actually.
So Harsha, thank you so much. It's been an honor to have you on my show, and I wish you lots and lots of success.
Thank you, Ashutosh. And thank you for the interview. It was great talking to you. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to The Brand Called You videocast and podcast, a platform that brings you knowledge, experience, and wisdom of hundreds of successful individuals from around the world. Do visit our website www.tbcy.in to watch and listen to the stories of many more individuals. You can also follow us on YouTube, Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Just search for The Brand Called You.